Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Joining your host, Jeff Frederick, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, are colleagues from across the university. The panel includes Brittany Bennett, the head coach of women's softball, Dan Kinney, the chief of staff of the Chancellor's Office, Barry O'Brien, the dean of the School of Business, Christy Poteet, director of the Office of Community and Civic Engagement, and Joe West, director of the Master of Public Administration program. Today's topic, leadership.
Leadership is a curious cocktail of attitude, communication, service, goal setting, experience, values, vision, strategy, growth, influence, humility, action, patience, and a score of other elements, some of which vary from day to day, others of which have to be on consistent and conspicuous display. When an organization has effective leadership across multiple levels, it is evident. When an organization does not, it's even more noticeable. Leadership is as timeless as Stonehenge, as every civilization has been served or saddled, as the case may be, by leadership strengths and weaknesses. How do we know leadership matters? Leadership training is ubiquitous. Within an hour's drive of wherever you live, there was quite probably a leadership seminar held last weekend. Amazon lists nearly 60,000 book titles on the topic, with an average of 4 new leadership books hitting the market on a daily basis. A cursory Google search on the topic yields 807 million responses. Full disclosure, I stopped a few short of reviewing all 807 million in preparation for today's broadcast. Leaders gain credibility when their values are lived rather than spoken, because action always speaks louder than words. Situational ethics, shifting rules, hypocrisy, and preferential treatment erode a leader's standing. Today, organizations may or may not be dependent on traditional conceptualizations of leadership. Even as globalization and the information revolution has changed the very nature of how we work, and often where we work, it has also changed communication, interaction, project management, and other day-to-day functions of leadership. In some cases, the needs of effective organizational leadership changes so often that the required substance and style of effective leadership can morph almost at a moment's notice. Crudely summarized, Moore's Law, first verbalized in 1965, argued that computational power would double every 2 years. In fact, it may actually be changing even faster than that, which means the flow of information and the amount of change a leader must process is coming at them faster than ever. 73 years ago, on the night before the launch of Operation Overlord, the campaign known as D-Day, Supreme Allied Commander Dwight Eisenhower penned a missive taking full responsibility for any potential defeat that might come at dawn. This is leadership accountability, a critical dimension of leadership service in action. Other leaders tend to adopt the sore loser approach, blaming any number of internal or external influences for their bad fortune. In fact, there's even a book called, quote, "It's Not My Fault." Those of you that watch House of Cards have seen Frank Underwood do this over and over again, always blaming others as a mechanism to stay in power. On a community level, I'm always blown away hearing youth sports coaches and parents say that the defeat their 8-year-olds just suffered, those same 8-year-olds who are much more fascinated by the post-game Mountain Dew and hot dog than anything that took place in the third inning or second quarter, say that the outcome was the umpire's fault. Do we train those who we love to be blame-based leaders? Every university, household, team, club, company, division, military detachment, agency, or even political party, no matter how big or small, global or local, rises and falls in part due to the leadership choices it makes or doesn't make. Errors of commission and errors of omission can be equally damaging to an organization. Famously, a former president was once asked, "What is it like running a country?" He said, "It's a lot like being in a cemetery. There's a lot of people below you, and none of them seem to be listening." Our topic for today, leadership. What is it? Why does it matter? How do you get better at it? And how is it different in the 21st century? Our guests today come from a variety of different perspectives as leaders who have led different types of organizations and studied leadership from several different perspectives. Some are deeply experienced leaders, others are newer into the process. Let me welcome Brittany Bennett, Dan Kenny, Barry O'Brien, Christy Poteet, and Joe West. Barry, get us started. What are the qualities of an effective leader? And are they born or are they made?
I think probably the most important thing is to set very clear goals. Those goals should be communicated to the team members. And I think it's really important to make sure that you hold yourself accountable for meeting those goals, not just the members of your team. But I think the buck does stop with the leader. And I think the more often you can tell the team where you fell short in achieving one of those goals, everyone's not going to succeed all the time. But as long as you don't lose sight of what the goals are and you're making progress towards achieving those goals, I think the team moves forward in a positive manner.
So a leader is a goal setter and a goal communicator. What other characteristics would y'all add?
So, Jeff, I would actually say that this is probably a false dichotomy. Are leaders born or are they bred or trained into being a leader? I think misses the point of leadership. And in public administration, there's an author by the name of Robert Denhard who wrote a book called The Dance of Leadership, where he likens leadership to a dance. And when we think of dancing, we think of motion and movement between multiple people that leaders, in fact, engage the people who are following them in a dance, if you will. And, sometimes that dance is a waltz, sometimes it's a polka, and yes, sometimes it's even a tap dance. But I think the bottom line is leadership or leaders aren't probably born or bred. And an effective leader in one situation is probably not an effective leader in another. So using the kind of the normative term of effective isn't particularly productive. And I've got a great example of that. Think of Donald Trump, who took the dance of CEO and did quite well at that dance. He took the dance of populist politician running for presidency. He did that dance fairly well. But all of a sudden, he's thrust into this executive role where he hasn't done that dance before. And in fact, the politicians on the House and the Senate side and even the judiciary haven't done his dance before. And you can see how that system is breaking down because they're not engaged.
So the music changes, the dance is a little different, and the success level can rise or fall.
Exactly.
What about the rest of y'all? Effective characteristics of leaders?
So I would add to that effective leaders also motivate and inspire others. And I think we have to get away from this idea that leadership is positional, that though sometimes it is tied to a title, that's not always necessarily the case. So when we ask questions like, are leaders born or are leaders made, anyone can do leadership. That belongs to everyone because it's created over a lifetime of experiences where you have motivated or inspired or encouraged others to do something different. That doesn't always take place when you hold a title, and maybe that means that you're not an effective leader. So when we move away from the idea that leaders are only those who hold titles, but leadership exists at all levels, then we can get to a place of what does it really mean to be an effective leader?
And we're heading in that direction in just a little bit, and that's a really interesting point.
You know, Jeff, I would say that leadership involves a lot of simple concepts with complex people. And, you know, I've said this so many times, I'm going to say it one more time. Leadership's all about relationships. And I think that the first thing that you have to do in a relationship is first seek to understand before you even think about being understood. And everybody around this table has talked about some of the challenges that presents. We're in a society today that expects results. Metrics are everywhere. I have great empathy for CEOs, for college presidents, for college coaches, because they've been on the job 3 months, and the expectations are ridiculous. But that concept of first seeking to understand before you're understood, it's embedded in a relationship, and it takes time.
It's like the old joke, Coach, we love you, win or tie, right? Everyone's expecting a national championship every year. Well, let's think about, can organizations can teams, can groups prosper with mediocre leaders? And this sort of goes to where Christy was saying, is that there can be leaders in all kinds of different levels. Can you get good outcomes without a top-down leader who seeks to understand?
So, you know, I think with respect to this particular question, can organizations prosper? I think of leadership as being so dynamic that potentially it depends on the organization. If you look at, for instance, Steve Jobs, most people would have said he was a very good leader. However, he was very mercurial, and that is not particularly a leadership skill that most, Jack Welch wouldn't say in his book Winning, yes, you should be mercurial, right? So I think, you know, leaders, when you talk about mediocre, well, I would say that Steve Jobs was very poor in one particular area, this personality issue. But in other areas, he was very good at motivating people to do the things that he wanted done. I suspect leaders are not always, they're not always mediocre in every area. You know, we have our strengths and our weaknesses. And I would say, by and large, at least in the private sector, if you're not a good enough leader to move your organization forward, you will be removed. Ultimately, the shareholders will remove you. Now, interestingly enough, in our world, in public administration, we have a principal-agent issue that is problematic in that removal is not always an option. And so there's a different dynamic in our world. So what's mediocre in the private sector is not necessarily mediocre in the public sector. Each is kind of different.
I think Dr. West makes it just a terrific point, and I enter into this discussion all the time with folks. Indeed, in the private sector, in corporate America, you know, if you don't lead effectively, if you don't win, if you don't earn profits, you'll be removed. The company might fail. The company might go bankrupt. I would argue that there's a litmus test in the nonprofit sector where most or all of us are employed. I often tell people that you can't have a leader who's not dynamic, because if you're not constantly innovating in higher education or in your sport, someone else is, and you're going to lose. Losing might look different in a nonprofit organization. It, the one without effective leadership just sort of muddles along. It doesn't grow. It doesn't transform people. It doesn't give the greatest customer service possible.
It misses opportunities.
It misses opportunities, and Dr. West's point is just really well made that way.
I heard many years ago, before, you know, I even started college, that good employees, good team members leave jobs or positions because of leadership. So, you know, can organizations prosper with mediocre leaders? Maybe for a little while, but not for long. As a civic engagement administrator, we focus a lot on servant leadership, and that means to empower others, to enrich their lives, to make sure that they are a part of a group. So if a mediocre leader is just one who approaches from the top down, who just says, this is what you need to do, let me give you direction, but never actually engages, doesn't lead by example, doesn't follow through, doesn't empower others to make decisions, to be a part of something bigger than what they are, then they're not going to focus on the mission. They're not going to focus on the goals because they don't believe in them. They're not their own. So do mediocre leaders prosper? Do they help organizations grow? Maybe when they're at their best, but not for long. It's not substantial.
I was just going to piggyback and say that myself. I do actually think I'm going to put a little wrench in this. I actually think that if you're a mediocre leader, that you can lead, but only for a short amount of time. And then the longevity of your employees, of the people around you, are going to change. And when you have those ever-changing dynamics, that's not leadership, because you're not going to have anything stable and something that's rock solid. There's a lot of people I've met in my travels where I've run into organizations where the people have been there for many, many years. And then you get into those scenarios and you can't walk away. away because you don't want to. You might have to, you know, to do better or be chasing some of your dreams and some of your goals. But the effective leadership that I've seen just in difference in mediocre is just that everybody is so engaged. If you walk down a hallway, you can really tell who's engaged in what they're trying to do. They'll speak to you. They'll say hello to you. They'll ask you how you're doing. It's not just, hey, yeah, they're down there. They'll get up and show you the way. Those things, I think, separate you. And I think those things that change you from mediocre to effectiveness actually are just based on personality traits and getting up and doing something and guiding someone without just saying, hey, as they pass by and they walk on.
You know, just real simply, I'll recap. I think that metrics tell us that people don't quit a profession. Athletes don't quit a sport. They quit the leader. And that's not universal, but I think that that happens more often than not. So leadership is important for continuity.
Well, let's look at it this way. Let's say in a results-oriented culture where you're expected to show improvement and show growth immediately. Let's say it doesn't happen immediately. How does a leader who either, you know, isn't as dynamic as some of you all have suggested, isn't as able to understand initially, how do they get their team back? How do they start off poorly and yet turn it around?
Well, I'll start off because I was probably one of those people early in my career. I did not start off strongly, but I was blessed that I had mentors that believed in me and paved the way for me. They took some of those bullets for me. And that allowed me to be committed to improvement. And I owe a great debt of that, a gratitude to a number of people that did that for me. And so I think that when you take a new position, one of the things that young people don't pay enough attention to is who are you going to be mentored by? You are not all that at the beginning of your career. Even though you might be drinking that Kool-Aid, there has to be somebody there that's going to mentor you. At least that was true in my case.
Everybody needs a little honesty from somebody.
I always make the point, I've had 5 associate deans over 16 years, and before any of them were allowed to accept the job, I wanted it to be very clear that they wanted to be a dean. Now, if they chose along the way not to be one, but I wanted them, I wanted them to think of themselves as a dean. And oftentimes, I've tried to empower them to be the dean, to be the decision maker, to have their back. I think that's important. You need to model leadership, and you need to compliment the people on your team when they're showing leadership. At times when maybe they don't know that they're doing it. You know, the example of, you know, a student 7:30 this morning trying to find a place to print a 3-page paper for an 8 o'clock class, and I see one of the folks on my staff open up a room so the kid can print his paper. It doesn't work. He walks the student down to his office and prints the paper for him. Now, there were other things he could have been doing during that 15 minutes. You know, and afterwards, I was like, you know, where do people like you come from? I'm so happy you're part of my team, you know?
Yeah, and that, I think, goes back to what Christy had said either earlier, is that leadership is not certainly entirely positional. It can come from all ranks of the organization. So when have you all seen grassroots or bottom-up leadership really change the culture of an institution? How does that work?
So I'm probably one of the newer persons at this table for this podcast, but I want to tell you, I was one of those people 4 years ago walking into a scenario where there was change that needed to be made. And this is a good question for me because it could go so many different branches and different roads as far as what I could say. But just to talk about it for just a second, when you walk into something that needs an organizational change and then you have to think about this grassroots thing. That's the first thing that I did. And it was difficult and it was hard because I wanted to say, hey, I'm the leader of this program and this is what I want you to do. But I wanted them to do it because they wanted to do it versus me telling them to do that. So I literally walked in the first day and I said, what do you want to see out of this program? And interestingly enough, and it's going back to a question we were just talking about, I'm actually doing that all over again 4 years later. Mm-hmm. This is the start of my 5th year. And we have had significant growth in our program. And then we just kind of got stagnant this year. So instead of sitting there and saying, hey, well, this is what happened, this is what happened, this is what's happened, I have done nothing but reach out to mentors, reach out to my peers, sit down and think about change. And when I'm doing that, I'm going grassroots all the way, which is a little bit different than what I've done in the past. And I'm going to go straight back to, what do you stand for? What do you want this program to stand for? And what do you want to see in this program? And that feedback will come directly from people that are 20 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. And that feedback will be the best feedback that I can get, because it's hard to hear and it's difficult to comprehend sometimes. But their voice on the ground, the ones that are in the trenches, that are doing the work, sometimes that feedback to me is going to be the reason why we can continue to lead and change and grow, and also take a different path than where we're at, which is, I think, a very difficult thing to do in leadership.
20 years younger, does that mean your student athletes are 10 years old?
No comment.
So I would agree that the reason that works, Brittany, is because you are engaging them in the process, that you're getting that buy-in. And grassroots leaders are often more passionate. It's not something that they inherited. It's not something that just comes with their position or their power, but something that they have a vested interest in, that they want to see that change. And that's why they're effective. And you take that with any type of leader. If you think about politics, for example, students, young students, we just did a voter education drive this past year, and young people don't vote. Not because they're not engaged, as we often think about. They find other ways to be engaged. They volunteer, they march, they post on their Facebook wall, they tweet. They are engaged in the process, but they don't vote because they don't think that it matters. They don't think that their voice is heard. And if you think about, in their lifetime, at least two presidential elections, the vote didn't matter as much. The individual vote did not matter as much. So for this younger generation, they're being taught that your vote doesn't matter. So they're finding other ways to engage. So it's not fair to say that young people just don't care, they're apathetic. That's not the case, but we're not engaging them in the process. Our leaders are not engaging them, and therefore they're not a part of this process and their voices aren't heard.
So I'll be a little bit of the fly in the ointment here.
He's good at that.
When we ask about effective top-down or grassroots leaders, I suspect that the truth is both of those leadership styles are important at different times. So there are times when you ask your people, what do you think is best, and you take kind of leadership from them a little bit. You determine what it is that they think is important, and you move in a direction they think is appropriate. But there are other times when an organization can be stuck in this morass and not moving anywhere, and there is no grassroots solution because all of the bits of grass point in different directions. We don't actually control how the people we lead respond, and they all may have different ideas. And the fact is, at some point, every leader, I suspect, will face a circumstance where they have to fall back on a top-down approach and say, look, I've got all your inputs, but based on this, I think this is the direction that we need to go. And in fact, all of us, especially everybody in this room, not only do we lead, but we are led by somebody else. And at some point, I think each of us recognize that there are points in time where we've said all that we can say and we've given all the input that we think is important, but we recognize that somebody above us has to make that decision. And then there are ways we can react, right? We can agree with that decision, we can disagree and accept it, or we can disagree and try to move in a different direction. All of those are appropriate responses. Some are more productive than others. So I guess I would argue that both forms of leadership are necessary in the long run for leaders.
We'll return to 30 Brave Minutes in a moment, but first, thank you for listening and for your financial support of the College of Arts and Sciences. Please consider a contribution to the Arts and Sciences Dean's Fund. The fund exists to help students and faculty make meaningful connections to the community, the state, and beyond through intellectual inquiry, scholarships, and research in the humanities, social sciences, and STEM fields. Consider a contribution today. Mark your envelope the Dean's Fund, College of Arts and Sciences, UNCP, Hickory Hall, Pembroke, North Carolina, 28372, or call the College of Arts and Sciences at 910-521-6198. You can also find us on the web. And now, back to 30 Brave Minutes and your host, Jeff Frederick.
I think some of the leadership qualities that I'm most drawn to are people who are able to get organizations to make dynamic changes, to move in a different direction, and to get buy-in, and to not change the vision of what that entity is, but attack it maybe in a different way. And I think that's a really challenging skill set, is to get people to buy into change. What has been y'all's experience in understanding how change is made and how leaders can help other members of the organization to participate in the change, embrace the change, you know, help the change to be successful?
I would say there's a great book on change that I have read multiple times, and it's by Dan and Chip Heath. They're both associated with Duke University. And they have some really simple concepts, and they tell a story about change. And for change to occur for an individual or for a team or organization, the analogy they use is you have a logical rider on top of an emotional elephant. And you have to manage both of these things to get the elephant, to get the rider to the point that you want to go. And one of the most brilliant things in that book is every organization, every individual has got bright spots. Replicate those. At this university, there are a number of things that individuals or small groups or departments do exceptionally well. Replicate it. Repeat it. You have to also shrink the change. You know, the elephant's going to get spooked if you have to tell him he's got to cross a 3,000-mile continent. But if you kind of can guide the path from point A to point B. So I do think that you have to manage two things. You have to manage logic, and you have to manage emotion. And if you don't pay attention to both, you won't get change.
You know, we've talked around leadership. We've talked about qualities of good leaders and all. A good analogy is that oftentimes as deans and department chairs, we have to evaluate teachers. And teachers will say, what are you looking for when you're watching me teach? And I always say, I don't know. I said, I've seen it done 1,000 beautiful ways. It's personal, it's individual, and I know it when I see it. And I think oftentimes when not that I evaluate leadership, when I look to see it, if I believe someone's a good leader or an effective leader, I've seen it done so many different ways. They come in different sexes, sizes, shapes, ethnicities. Some of the smallest, shortest people are the most dynamic leaders. Size has been no advantage to me trying to lead. And so I think it's a very nuanced kind of thing, right? Leaders go about it in a bunch of different ways. That's why you had 10 million hits when you Googled leadership.
Yeah, that's just last week, too. Well, let's go in a different direction, because one of the things that I believe is a responsibility of leaders is to groom their replacements, to identify talent and to develop it and to provide people with opportunities for them to reach their professional goals. How do you do that in your own walks of life? How important is it for an organization to be thinking about the next change?
Someone told me just yesterday that it's great to ride the success elevator all the way to the top, but you got to make sure you send it back down for the next person. Mm-hmm. And I think as a leader, that's your responsibility. Right now, you know, at the university in our division, we're thinking about succession planning. Who could take my spot? If there's no one at the university who could take my job, then I'm not doing a very good job of training my staff to grow and develop in a way that's going to be beneficial for them, for our department, for our university, or for our students. So it always has to be in your mind, what are you doing for others? And I think that's what a servant leader is. Like, how are you creating a more just world by empowering those around you to be in a place where they can make change, where they can make decisions that are going to influence and empower others? So I think it has to be at the core. What are you doing to empower others?
I think that's my job 100%. I'm grooming 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds to enter the job market. Outside of my teaching responsibilities, it is completely 100% of my job is to make a kid 4 years older by the time they exit my program. And I think that comes with a lot of heartache. It is 100% something that I am dedicated to as far as mentorship, and it comes at a very costly price. I have spent a lot of hours in my office with kids and players in my office crying. A lot of that's because they're going through something that they need to get out, and they're looking at me for guidance, and I'm not telling them anything at all. I'm just listening to what they have to say, and they're coming up with their own solutions as we're going. I want to sometimes say, hey, kid, this is what I think you should do. I've lived life long enough to know that this might work for you, but getting them to come to their own solutions. I think I have that all the way from just my players being young to my assistant coaches and graduate assistants that I'm trying to groom to get to take their own jobs and be their own head coaches. And I think the power is in them. I think the power of the voice is in them. All the time I say, hey, what do you want to do here? Hey, what would you do if you were me? Hey, how would you write this lineup? Hey, how would you do this? And sometimes I don't go with it. You know, I have to make that decision top down to say, hey, that's not what's best for our program right now. But probably every third or fourth time, I'm giving all that power to them, and it comes at a cost sometimes. And I think that they see me as a human and realize, hey, we tried that and it didn't work, but we did it together. And I think togetherness in leadership is just what you get people to move them to the right direction. Barry was talking about it earlier, about what the effective leadership is, but really we can teach, if you're a good leader, you can teach them to do whatever you want them to do, because you're going to guide them down the path you want them to go. And we all know that sometimes those paths are incorrect in the wrong way, and we have terrible leaders, and we have leaders that take people the right way. I think your approach is different to every single person. I am a different leader than most people that I know, but that's because I'm emotional, and I'm in your face, and I love you for who you are. But I think just knowing that you can give the power to your people and just say, hey, I might take a little bit with this, but I'll take the blame and I'll take responsibility for it, really helps grow those young, some people can be older than you in your job, but just get them to where you need them to be mentally, physically, emotionally, to be that leader they need to be.
I'll add something here. By the way, for the people who can't be in the room and see what just happened, when Brittany pointed towards the wrong leaders, her hand went my direction. Yeah. She pointed towards the right leaders and went towards
right-handed.
Dan Kinney. So just let's have that on the record. Now, with respect to your question about succession planning, I think succession planning is incredibly important, both in the public sector and in the private sector. However, in both cases, the person who's going to succeed you may or may not actually fit into that role very well. And so you need to be willing to say, here's my succession plan, but at this point, I'm going to go external, right? And so I think private organizations do that, public organizations do that. And so while succession planning is important, you should not be wed to it so much that you're not willing to look a different direction when that's necessary.
You know, I'll say a couple of things. One is, I think give people opportunities to fail and let it be a teachable moment, not an attack on their personality. And again, I mentioned earlier, I've been blessed that I've had some people that gave me that opportunity. I remember the first year I was athletic director, I made every mistake an athletic director could make, but I had a supportive chancellor that didn't judge me as being totally inept. The second thing that I want to say is, I think if you're a leader, always be on the lookout for other leaders. It's kind of served me well with my friendships that I have pointed out to people that are in a totally unrelated, you know, occupation. Hey, here's a reference that you might want to explore. I'm not in banking, but I've encountered this guy when I go to the bank. And I think that that's one thing that we can all do as leaders, observe other leaders, make note of them. And I really said two things, but I'll finish with a third thing. It really is true. If you're in a position of leadership, as Joe said, you have to be building a list for every position you have in your organization. Some of the people on that list are going to be internal, but you need to have external, because I think that hiring is the most important thing a leader does. It's the most powerful thing that you do for your organization. Who do you choose to bring on the team? And, you know, you need to make sure that you can do that well.
All right, final question, lightning round. Who's a leader that you look up to and respect to? Could be living, could be passed on, but each of you indicate a leader that you think is the epitome of what we should strive to be.
This will be a little hokey, but in one way maybe a little embarrassing, except I love him so much, is my younger brother. the question that Dr. West answered, can leaders be born? When he was very, very young, laying in bed at night, one of eight kids side by side with my other brothers sleeping at our feet. I remember him laying there one night, and the mecca of basketball in Philadelphia was the Palestra. And he was dreaming about his sophomore year and said he wanted to have the basketball in his hands at the Palestra as a point guard, where he could control the other nine people on the court and the 10,000 people in the fan and lead his team to victory. But he wins, but not at all costs. He has great integrity. And another guy who has great integrity in his leadership is Dan Kenny. I've learned a lot from him through the years, even though he's a good bit younger than I am. But he's the same guy every time I meet him. He's not one of these guys, you don't see him for 3 or 4 years, all of a sudden he's about something else. And that kind of consistency and tenacity in leadership, I greatly admire.
Well, I have two. One would be my mom. She was a single parent and reminded me every day that I was capable. So she is the one that empowered me to have a voice and to share my voice and to be the strong, independent woman that I am today.
But also, did well.
Thank you. I'll tell her. Maybe she'll listen to this. Thanks, Mom.
Gotta send it to her.
Yeah. Thanks, Mom. But then also my college mentor, Billy Wooten at Berea College, he reminded me again that the path that was set for me was not the one that I had to go down. I was a first-generation college student, did not know what I was doing when I first got there. I was going to law school because that's what I thought I needed to do to make money. Quickly, I realized that to change the world, I needed to do just what other people had done for me. And that's how I got to where I'm at today, thanks to those two.
I'll say two. One's in the room. Dan Kenny has been a huge mentor to me, especially since I've been at Pembroke. He speaks to me every single time. He comes by my office, and it makes my day secretly. So, the second one is Wendell Stanton. He's the athletics director at Georgia College, and he was really just a huge person. A lot of people in this room actually know who he is because of his roots here at Pembroke. But the reason why he is such an influential leader to me is because he just invested in me, and I am sitting here today because of him. And I'm thankful for all the things that he's taught me. And he's a good friend to these days. Every time I see him, it's like we've never been apart from each other. But just a huge guy in my life for many reasons I cannot do in 20 seconds. But just a huge leader in my life and a big influence in my life.
Well, for me, it's three people. It's my mom, my wife, and Ray Pennington. And all three of them did one thing in common for me. They believed in me before I could believe in myself in certain situations. So I think that those are my three.
And for me, it's definitely got to be Donald Trump. No, okay, stop that. I'm joking.
I lit the green thing up there.
So with respect to somebody that I respect and a leader that I respect a great deal, I really have to think back to my junior college days to a professor who kind of took me aside and allowed me into a program that he wasn't certain that I'd be able to succeed in. And he gave me a chance, and I think he did that with a large number of students, and he sent me on my way. And so, you know, it turns out that for me, a university professor was probably... He did the type of leadership that made a difference in my life, and I wouldn't be where I am today without that.
Well, this has been a great discussion. I appreciate our panel of distinguished leaders for giving us some good insights into leadership. If you enjoy this broadcast, pass it on to someone else, and we'll see you next time on 30 Brave Minutes.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or Indian industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves.